Hello, everyone. Welcome to Laser Focus. This is the deep dive pop culture podcast from Nerdist. My name is Kyle Anderson. Thank you so much for listening. This week, I'm very excited. I'm always excited. It's always good when we have a guest on the show who isn't one of my coworkers. but I'm very stoked. This guy, you will know if you've been reading comics in the recent years. You'll know him from Green Arrow, Teen Titans, and since 2019 has been writing under the banner of all the X titles, on the titles X-Force, which just wrapped 50 issues, and Wolverine, which is just about to wrap 50 issues, which is quite a milestone. Please welcome Benjamin Percy. Hello, sir.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. And I have not used a voice modulator. That is Ben's actual voice, which I'm sure you hear all the time.
I sound like a buffalo. If a buffalo can talk, that's me.
Which of the characters in X-Force, and this is the beginning of the questions, do you think you would provide the voice for?
Oh, wow.
If you could voice one of your own characters, which one sounds the most like you in your head?
Well, I mean, I sound like slightly monstrous, so ideally a bad guy.
Sure.
You know, there's maybe a little bit too much nasal passage in my voice for Sabretooth. So who do we have left? Who's some big hulking brute?
I mean, you could do, I mean, if you put on an accent, you could do Omega Red, maybe, or Omega
Red. Duh, I am Omega Red. Yeah, that would be a good nasty figure to take on, sure.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So this is officially canon Omega Red voice right now.
Good, I love it. And you heard it here first. Yeah, before we get into, because I do like this episode, folks, if you haven't read X-Force for the last 5 years, I mean, go back and read all of it. But we are going to get into kind of the nuts and bolts of the characters and the story and everything like that. It's one of my favorite titles in the under the Krakoa era, I guess is what the entire thing is called. And I do want to get into that. But first, what did you grow up reading? What were your comics you read? And what were sort of like your pop culture nerdy stuff that you were into when you were coming up?
So I grew up moving around a lot. And as a result of that, I have no sense of comics continuity because I would be buying comics from convenience stores, grocery stores, flea markets, garage sales, wherever I could find them, antique shops. And, you know, I might be in a comic shop once a year. I might be in a comic shop 10 times a year. It would just depend on life circumstances. And even if I was buying something that appeared to be new, like it was on a spinner rack, you know, at a mercantile. Like, those were my first comics, really. It was in Crow, Oregon. That's where I lived for the first 5-6 years of my life. And my mom would take me to this mercantile. That's how small the town was. There was no grocery store. It was a mercantile with, like, wide board plank flooring and lacquered fish on the walls. And you walked in and just the smell of the butcher counter slapped you in the face. And I would always sit at the base of that spinner rack while my mom shopped. And if I was good, she'd let me take home, you know, a comic, one issue. It was either that or, you know, bubble gum or chocolate. And I wanted cape and spandex. And anyways, I would be buying from this mercantile, but the comics themselves were sometimes 2 or 3 years old. That I was picking up. So anyways, I read and was drawn to a lot of the horror comics, like Man-Thing was an early obsession. I also burned my way through all of the EC comics. I still have those to this day, and they're very well loved and falling apart. I was obsessed with Wolverine. I was obsessed with Punisher and Warlord was also. I love Sword and, you know, like Sword and Sandal stuff, just epic fantasy. You know, I had a lot of Conan comics as well. And then there was, of course, Batman. But, like, sprinkled into all of this, there's all just, like, the random grab bag of Spider-Man, Superman, Thor, Moon Knight, whatever.
That's so it.
I don't have, like, the deep-cut nerd knowledge that a lot of comics folk comics folks have. Like, I'm more scattered all over the place and then siloed interests in, like, knows everything about Conan, Punisher, and Wolverine.
I mean, that's not a bad thing. And I was just about to say, like, that is something that people who grew up kind of pre the internet, that's just what you had to do. Like, I definitely remember getting just random issues of Spider-Man. And I remember there was one issue of Spider-Man where he fought like a big giant, like skinhead Nazi blob or something like that. And I have been trying forever to figure out what issue that was, or if it was like a special issue, but it was like a blob of white supremacy. Yeah. But so I've had that, you know, but that's what we had to do when we were kids. Like, and I remember, like, yeah, Wolverine is one that, like, I think you obviously know, you've written two books with Wolverine in it, but like, you can't escape Wolverine. I feel like at this point he is up there with Batman and Superman and Spider-Man as like the one that people, if anybody knows anything about comic books, I feel like Wolverine, they'll be like, oh, I know Wolverine. I mean, it's Hugh Jackman, you know what I mean? But
I say that's generally true, but every day I'm encountering people, it seems like, who, when they hear I'm running comics, they're like, what comics are still sold?
And oh, wow.
And talk to me further, and I'll be like, yeah, you know, I write Wolverine. And they're like, who? He's a wolf?
Oh, boy.
He's a werewolf? You know, the guy with the three claws. Hugh Jackman plays him. And they'll be like, you mean the guy from that musical?
So I know there, we there are. Is,
despite the fact that I'm immersed in geek culture and you know, it sometimes feels like everybody knows. And
yeah.
Wolverine. There's still like, you know, a healthy segment of the population that has no idea what is going on in the world of comics.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. We sort of get in our own worlds, but that's the fun. Like, we have the fun worlds. We get to talk about fictional characters, superheroes and stuff. Yeah. Do you feel like you got like a good, you know, because you were getting these run of random issues, like a good, maybe not complete knowledge of any characters, but like a breadth of knowledge. Like, I never read any Thor growing up, so you're already one up on me. But like, do you feel like you got a good idea of who all was out there because of that?
Definitely. I mean, I would say that I'm very well versed on comics, but comics, you know, the well is so deep. Mm-hmm. That when I'm sometimes in the room, you know, if I'm at a summit with all of these, you know, legendary comics editors and all these brilliant comics writers, and they're at the boardroom table and they're pitching things left and right, sometimes that's when I'm like, oh, I need to like get out my phone sort of surreptitiously here and Google who this character is that they're talking about. But, you know, comics were an obsession of mine early on because they were aspirational, obviously, and because, you know, they're, you know, mythic and exciting, but also because they were kind of a constant in my life. Like, no matter where I was living, no matter I was in eight different schools or something growing up, you know, I always had like a sense of continuity in my life.
Right.
Through these characters.
You know, you said you know everything about Conan the Barbarian. Have you gone back and read all the, like...
Oh, no, now you're going to quiz me and I'm going to...
No, I don't know much. I was just going to ask if you've gone back and read, like, all the Robert E. Howard stuff or if it's just the Marvel. I mean, because Marvel's
I read my way through all of those paperback novels when I was in middle school and high school. And I also collected, you know, Savage Sword.
Right.
As well as just the mainline Conan. And it, you know, the... I recently rewatched the Arnold film, which I've probably seen close to 20 times, and it was a good feeling knowing that I could still quote readily most of the script. And anyways, I don't know. This is something about Conan for me that borders on a religious experience.
Right. And I
have no idea what that says about myself, that I love this guy who wears hairy underpants and roams around, you know, this, you know, taking out giant snakes and battling apes and dungeons and everything else. But I just, I'm a geek for fantasy.
If somebody's, you know, if I'm trying to quiz them, which I very rarely do, I like what you like, but I will say, Conan, what is best in life? And if they answer,
Crush your enemies to see them driven before you and to hear the lamentation of the women.
It's so good. And the push in, if anybody hasn't seen Conan the Barbarian, the second one, not as good, I think is widely acknowledged, but the first one is very, very good. For
my
what it is.
Part of that film is when, you know, Conan, he's been, you know, taken prisoner as a child after his parents were killed in that village attack. And he's lashed to the wheel of pain. Right. And he just goes around and around with these other kids pushing this wheel of pain. And the purpose of the wheel of pain is never evident. I mean, you assume that maybe they're grinding grain or something, but it doesn't matter. There's just the wheel, the constancy of it. And one by one, all of these kids fall. And in the end, there's just Conan pushing. And you have this time lapse that occurs where, you know, as the kids are dropping left and right, and his head is pushed down, like his body keeps getting bigger and bigger until when he finally lifts his head and stares into the camera, it's Arnold. You know, he spent like 15 years in this rut pushing the wheel of pain.
I mean, you get a pretty good deltoids doing that, I guess, because boy.
That's my workout plan.
Yeah. Wheel of pain.
I'll be back in 15. Going to get on the wheel of pain.
Oh, the elliptical is full. Okay. I'll get on the wheel of pain.
CrossFit workout of choice.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. So let's dive into X-Force. Congratulations, first of all, on a 50 issue run of that.
Crazy.
Did you,
unbelievable.
Yeah. I was going to say very grateful. You and Jerry Duggan are the only two or the two remaining original writers from the first pitch, or, you know, the first gathering of writers. Jerry's obviously moved on from Marauders to X-Men and done a bunch of other stuff too, but you've stayed on X-Force the entire time. Did you, like, as you were getting further along, were you like, are you guys, am I just going to stay on this? Or did you at some point go, I think I'm on this for the long haul? When did it sort of become evident to you?
Well, right away, when we got called into that first X Summit, when we were in the Marvel mothership, talking about teams, talking about titles, talking about what the next few years had in store for us, we knew from Hickman that we had a bit of rope. So I always knew that this wasn't just going to be 5 issues. Mm. It wasn't just going to be 10 issues. I'm amazed and thankful that I got to 50, not just 50 once, but 50 twice.
Right.
That's such a rarity in this day and age of comics. And it felt really special that, you know, it would be special to write for the mutants at any point.
Mm.
But to do it now, it just feels like kind of a signature moment. And I can't say that I ever knew for sure that I was going to get to 30, to 40, to 50. But I knew that I would have a longer than standard run. I knew that it wasn't just going to be the, you know, the 5-issue sprint, the 10-issue, see ya, so long. So, in other words, always grinding, doing my best to tell stories that would continue to bring people back month after month in the hopes that this would be marathonic and novelistic, but never really knowing if I would get past 25.
Right. Yeah, I feel like, as you kind of alluded to, like nowadays, 25 is like, oh my gosh, that he was on that book for a long time, like because of how much churn there is, I guess, in the comics world at the moment. Like, some of the best runs recently are, you know, little thin volumes, like, hey, the complete works of this guy on this title. And it's
sometimes that's all it takes, right?
Right.
Sometimes you can write 5 issues and still have the definitive Moon Knight or something.
Right. So yeah, I want to get in. So the first X Summit, when you like you said, you were talking about teams. You'd mentioned in your there's a really great, you know, kind of an afterword you wrote in the issue 50, kind of going back to the original and saying that, you know, Jonathan Hickman just called you up and you were like, well, I'm going to take this call. I love that story. But how did it be? Did you claim X
Hickman? Doesn't matter if
right.
In this instance, I was walking into Halloween, the remake of Halloween. And, you know, I, I don't like to miss my previews, but
right
but now. In this case, I was like, oh, damn it, Hickman. I hung around.
He texted me to see if I'm taking calls. No, not Hickman.
Yeah, and he said, you know,
I think you'd kill it on X-Force.
And I took him literally. I took him at his word.
It was absolutely.
The murder book.
The murder book. Yeah, you've described it as the murder book. And I think that's what sets it apart, I think, initially, is that in this realm of, you know, what Hickman set up with Hoxpox, that the mutant nation of Krakoa will kill no humans. Well, kind of, you gotta kill some humans once in a while. How did you go? And I know you'd also said, what do I want to start with? Okay, so I know you'd said that you had put the Beast, Wolverine kind of butting of heads as front and center to your idea. When did you realize I want these two guys specifically? And at what point did you kind of go, okay, Beast is actually going to take the more militant approach, because that is kind of atypical for him in a lot of versions of Beast.
Yeah. What I was thinking was, you know, this is an infant nation. And if they're going to take this aggressive stance and become a sovereign power, they need to kill some people, because that's how nation building works. And if they are the mutant CIA, there's going to be shadow operations happening throughout the world that Xavier isn't going to want to know about, but recognizes, if you look at the dirty track record of this world and human civilization, if you're on top, you're doing terrible things. And it made sense to me to have, you know, a splintered faction within the organization, and the lines became very clear. Here you have a director of intelligence, and then here you have a director of field ops doing the wet work. So Beast is the head and Wolverine is the fist. Beast has carte blanche, you know. Xavier tells him to do what needs to be done. And we never actually see Xavier condemn Beast. In a way, because in my mind, which I can't say that anybody else in the Krakoan group would agree with, or the editorial would agree with, but that he knew all along something like this was going to happen. And you know, he keeps his hands clean as best he can by staying out of this business. But, you know, I knew that Beast's, you know, rank would be challenged. That, you know, from the very beginning, if you look at the first scene in issue one, the first scene that's actually on Krakoa after the cold open with Domino and the man with the peacock tattoo, that it's between Beast and Wolverine. You know, so right. From the very beginning, I knew that's where it would start and that's where it would end as well, with the two of them. And I like the idea of somebody who is so studious, so philosophical, so, you know, so inward, and such a chess master, to be somebody enacting terrible violence, which is something we normally associate with Wolverine.
Right.
Well, Wolverine would slowly move in the other direction. It's not that he wouldn't be hacking and slashing, but his mind would begin to sharpen and resist, you know, the orders coming from on high. So the two of them were just always due to butt heads and to go to war. The ultimate war would be not without, but within.
Right. I mean, because you know, as the book goes along, like, Beast obviously becomes more and more of the straight up antagonist and not just an antagonistic force. But I always kind of read him early on as, like, he's just afraid. Like, this is, he doesn't want to lose all the stuff that they've built. And so, like, he, you know, you got to get your hands dirty, or he believes so. So it feels to me, or it felt to me, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that, like, Beast at that point was like, I'm going to take this as far as I can, because somebody has to. And if we keep, you know, I just have to, I'm putting all this on myself. I'm going to be the one who makes all the hard choices and do all the bad stuff, and be the bad guy.
Yeah. I mean, it's a utopian communities are an impossibility.
Right.
This has been proven time and time again, and Beast knows what has to be done for them to secure this sense of nationhood, for them to save themselves from the world. So I wanted to make sure that his aggression was underscored by a code at all times. And he has a utilitarian, you know, sort of manifest.
Right.
At the fore of his mind, which is the greatest good for the greatest number of mutants, no matter the cost. So if that means, you know, he's going to be engaged in, you know, assassination or Banana Republic antics or manipulating elections or whatever the dirty deeds done dirt cheap.
Right.
He will engage with that, and to the degree that he'll take it on all himself as he does toward the end. Like, he'll go rogue.
Yeah.
And sort of save his group from having to bear this burden themselves.
It's such an interesting, you know, arc for that character. And I think if, you know, if people only know Beast from the animated series or from some of his like happier go lucky, which you obviously reference when the clone Beast appears and he's saying, "Oh, my stars and garters and all that stuff." I think you could look at Beast and go, "Oh my God, where, like, how is he so different?" But there's precedent for it, is my point.
Yeah. Yeah. You look back on, you know, the long hoof mark trail of Marvel history. And
yeah.
Beast has been up to some sketchy stuff. You know, the legacy virus or the Inhumans or Threnody, whatever. Like, you know, it's just been flirtations.
Right.
With darkness that, you know, once he's given sort of, you know, uninhibited power, that's going to corrupt anyone. But
yeah.
I also want the audience in the end to really settle on that question: was Beast right?
Right.
And I think that the knee-jerk reaction of most X readers will be that Beast was wrong and Beast is terrible. But you know, you look at what happened with Magneto as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's always somebody walking around the con with the Magneto was right shirt.
Yep. When I was just talking to a coworker about this today, but like there was that whole thing with Cyclops was right. The same thing. Like if you go a militant route, eventually there are going to be people who are like, you know what? He actually had the right idea. That's okay. We'll get back to Beast because obviously he's a huge part of this, but I want to talk about, did all of you literally sit there and like recess kickball go, I'll have this one and I'll have this character? Was it literally like that? Or was it like, did you have specific pitches?
Was like that.
Really? That's so fun.
We wrote out not every mutant because there's so many.
There are quite a bit of them. Yes.
But there were probably 200 note cards, 3x5 note cards.
Dang.
Of mutant names on the boardroom table. And there was a lot of just, let's move these over here. And let's move these over here. And let's talk about this as a group right now. Like, what does this look like for Excalibur or Marauders or X-Force or the X-Men? And what if we swap out this one for that one and so on? And so with X-Force, you know, it was a matter of like, okay, who's the intelligence squad? Who's the field squad? Is there going to be any swappage? You know, I wanted Jean on X-Force in the beginning, in part because I wanted her to quit.
Right.
Because I wanted her to be like, hell no. Like,
yeah.
After she realized what they were going to be as an organization, I wanted somebody to walk away. And so there were arguments made with those things in mind. I mean, originally I had characters like Mask on there to do like Mission Impossible style.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's just like you can only have your roster get so big
before
it's a kind of a mess. So,
but that is kind of the beauty of the X universe. I mean, within the Marvel universe is that there's 98 million mutant characters, and you know, even this era.
You can pop in them in and out. Like somebody doesn't officially have to be like the main roster of X-Force.
Exactly.
You can still use them. You know, you can go over here to portal your way across the world with this character. You can go down to, you know, the arsenal with Forge and get hooked up with this, you know, giant cool gun and then leave. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have to be like the mainstays.
So initially you had Beast and Wolverine, and then Jean, like you mentioned, she quits. It's a brilliant group of people, because you have the intelligence group, which is Jean, Sage, and Beast, and then in the Fist you have Wolverine, Domino, which makes perfect sense, and then Kid Omega was a kind of a wild card in my head, because obviously he's a brash character and everything like that. And I love the early on you have him. He's like, I should be on the intelligence. What am I doing out in the field? Because he thinks he's the best one out there. And you have a really interesting arc with him. What were some of the, when you initially had, okay, here's my roster lineup. Where did you think you would take those characters? And do you feel like you did what you thought you were going to do?
With Kid Omega, I saw somebody with so much storytelling potential, because he's a brat.
Yeah.
And yet he's an Omega level mutant. Right?
Yeah.
He's ridiculously powerful. And yet his own personality gets in the way of him transcending sort of like these limitations, these fences that he's built, psychological fences that he's built around himself. And some of that comes from the way, you know, trauma that he endured. And some of that comes from the fact that he's just a total a-hole. And so what I wanted to do was play around with the idea of resurrection. If there was, you know, it gave me so much pleasure to be able to kill my characters and, bring them back. And for a while there, Kid Omega was my Kenny.
Right.
You know, I would just have him die and die and die and die on almost every mission. And he was getting so pissed about this. but what ended up happening was that he started to, you know, think a little bit more deeply about what it meant to be alive and what it meant to contribute to a group. And it sort of allowed for a true resurrection, you know, in that within this series, he develops essentially a new ID, a new, you know, MO. And he changes his costume, he changes his attitude. I mean, we had to keep some of that punk quality to
him. Of course.
But there's a little bit of growing up that happens. And part of this is through his relationship with Phoebe. So I ended up having a lot of fun with that character.
Yeah, and he definitely went places that I wouldn't have expected, and I think that's obviously the point of having him in the book. But like, I think it's funny that like he's the one who's like, whereas young Cable is like the playboy, Quentin's the one who's like, I'm devoted to this one particular cuckoo. And I think that's like, it's very adorable, needy, and it's also really nice. Insecure. Like I love their relationship. Yeah.
Yeah. He's very needy and insecure, and
yeah.
Somebody who can see through his bullshit is appealing.
Yeah.
Who, like, he can't be his usual self because they can, like, look into his, directly into his brain and know better.
Yeah.
I'm always looking for a challenge when I'm writing. And in the case of Kid Omega, I was like, I'm going to take somebody who most people absolutely hate and try to make them kind of like him.
I mean, it definitely worked. Like, he became one of my favorites.
He's kind of like it's a group of misfits.
Absolutely, yeah.
So he fits right in that regard.
What's it like having your version of Kid Omega as the action figure? The first version, yeah. I think he's the first action figure of Kid Omega. It's the X-Force Kid Omega.
That's pretty badass. And you know, being able to work with Joshua Cassara, who ended up jumping over to X-Men, because he's just meteoric, you know, this rise that he's had. He's so talented. We became really tight on X-Force. We still text almost every day. despite the fact that we haven't been working together for a few years now. We're just really good friends, and to be able to develop that new design with him was awesome.
Yeah.
It's we each have our toys now on a shelf.
Yeah. That's so cool. Oh man. One character who comes in early on and then, kind of goes away for a little bit and then comes back into it in a big, big way is Colossus. He's on the cover of the first issue. And then he kind of is like, I don't want to have any part of this, and goes and like farms for a while. And then obviously he's the sleeper agent. Like if you have any sleeper agents in there, it's him. And I think his is the most one of the tragic arcs in the entire saga. If you could talk a little bit about like developing him and like kind of making him, you know, go on this horrible, you know, ride where he's not in control of himself.
Yeah, it was an espionage book. I wanted to make sure there was a traitor. You see it seeded from the very first issue. And this is another one of those things that I knew was going to be a long-form storytelling deal where I'm putting my novelistic chops to work. You know, when he's brought back to the island, you know, he's escaped Russia with these refugees. Russia's one of the countries that didn't sign the treaty. So in war-torn circumstances, they escaped, and he dumps them off, and he's, you know, heavily damaged, and you're thinking of him sympathetically, heroically, except that when he's in, you know, the healing gardens, there's that moment in the first issue where his eyes just snap open and he has that dead expression. And maybe you begin to wonder if everything is all right with dear Pyotr. And it's a slow burn, right?
Yeah.
And part of that was messing with the audience, and part of that was messing with his fellow mutants. But I had this idea in tandem with this. There was never, I'm sure somebody can be annoying and be like, well, actually. But there was never really a character who was a mutant who was a writer. And I mean that their power was achieved through their writing. And so I had this idea for a character called the Chronicler. And the Chronicler's powers is that whatever they would write would come true. And that's not like an unbound power. They can't just write, you know, the world exploded and the world will explode. They have to work at it sort of the same way that a writer works at things, where you have to inhabit the psychology of a character in order for the story to feel true, the story for reality sort of to bend around the narrative you're crafting. So in the, you know, I thought that a Russian writer, you know, I thought of Tolstoy, I thought of Dostoevsky, I was thinking of Gogol, I was thinking of like, you know, Chekhov, some of the great writers, like it just seemed perfect that it would be a Russian writer. And I, you know, started to have these data pages that had no context. And the data pages would start to pop up in these issues where it would be describing something that was happening to Colossus, or something that was happening on the island that Colossus might have been observing. And it was like, what happens is this character, the Chronicler, he's been introduced to and interrogated Colossus, and the Chronicler himself, as we later understand, is in a gulag that Mikhail runs. And he's being forced to do this, but his muse is Colossus. And so Colossus is a sleeper agent who is unaware or barely aware and not in control of what he's doing because he's being manipulated by the Chronicler. And you'll start to see passages that are crossed out and then rewritten. And then what was rewritten is what you actually saw in the comic. And so I wanted to just seed these clues, and it went on and on and on and went on for a long time. And people were like, what is going on here? You'd see like at the bottom of these passages, the Chronicler, that was who always signed off on it. It was just, you know, one of those things that I had in mind from the beginning and I thought would really be really fun to play out. And yeah, he's, you know, filled with regret and remorse. And here's this guy who's, you know, covered in armor and who hides himself beneath a beard, who has some great secrets trapped within him.
Yeah. And that, like, I forget which issue it is, but where he murders effectively his girlfriend. Yep. And that was like, that was honestly the first time you're really like, oh, okay, something is very wrong with him. It's not just that he has PTSD, which is initially what I thought, you know, what could have happened to him?
He's painting.
Yeah.
You know, and only in the paintings do you see like how tortured he is.
Yeah.
Because he's, you know, I was giving examples to the artists of, you know, some of Goya's work, like Saturn devouring his son, or, you know, Edward Munch, The Scream, or Sir Francis Bacon, you know, like some, these artists that are really upsetting to look at their work. And I was like, okay, do this except with Mikhail. So he's always like drawing these nightmarish portraits of Mikhail, but nobody else sees what he's even doing, even though it's a cry for help.
I mean, it's such an interesting, and I love like the way you describe the chronicler, because that is you are a writer, but that is a very writerly thing to do. It's like the writer is not all powerful. They are just mostly powerful.
You can never have a power that can just be like,
yeah,
anything can happen. Because that's, you know, you have to have rules behind powers.
It can't just be limitation. Yeah.
Where if he wasn't in tune with Colossus, then it wouldn't work what he was trying to do.
And I loved at the end of that arc too, because he's like, well, no, I have to finish. Like, that's like, even though everything's blown up, essentially, like the scheme is over. He's like, no, I still have to finish. And I think that is a very relatable thing for anybody who's tried any creative endeavor.
Would have been some meta commentary in there.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk too a little bit about, so Sage again is a character that I think I'm definitely is a Claremont creation, but had not been particularly used extensively for a long time. She really steps up, especially after Beast kind of goes off the deep end, as sort of like, she's effectively the head of the intelligence branch after a while.
Yeah. I knew
really
that
a great character.
Get ousted.
Yeah.
The same way that I knew that Gene was going to quit.
Yeah.
And Sage was always, you know, just off stage waiting to become the director of intelligence. And I had to, you know, we had to see her sort of grow into that role.
Mm-hmm.
So she's struggling at first. She's haunted. Like all these characters are haunted.
Yeah.
By what she's doing. I mean, just like sometimes it feels like 24/7, she's crunching numbers. She's running algorithms. She's, you know, looking at what's happening in this nation and this nation and this nation and trying to figure out who's about to attack them and how best to stop them. And it just kind of drives her crazy. To the degree that she's numbing her brain every night with, you know, as much booze as she can douse down her throat. And so she struggles with that and overcomes that addiction and at the same time rises up into the responsibility of being the director of intelligence with a more clear-eyed view of what they're doing and a hope that they can have maybe not a morally upright stance, but a more nuanced position than let's kill anybody in our way.
Right. And she, at the end, when we have the two beasts, she's the one who's putting, like, Wolverine just like, kill both of them. We just got to get him out of here. And she's like, no, let's trust it. It's going to work. And I think that, again, is a really big moment for her character. Like, we have to trust this plan. It can't just be murder, even though that's what we've been doing for. Yeah, it was
we
really
can't be the murder book. That's essentially we go from murder book to we can't be the murder book.
Yeah,
that's the arc of it.
I mean, that's a pretty good arc. One of the other great things I love about the Krakoa era is that the villains, traditional villains and heroes, kind of have to coexist just by virtue of like, hey, we're the mutants, we have to kind of make this all work. And that was true on all the books, but on yours you had Black Tom as the kind of the representative who talks to Krakoa itself, and I thought he was a delight. But then you also had Omega Red, who has a really interesting, like, you did X Lives and Deaths of Wolverine, obviously, where he is the straight up bad guy in that. And then he becomes part of the team. And like, he's a same with Sabretooth, just a kind of almost an irredeemable character. And yet he's been redeemed in that book. What were your sort of thoughts on incorporating those two villains?
Yeah. Again, just like the challenge of taking on unlikable characters. I love it. And Omega Red, you know, I like it when people don't just fall back on the obvious baddies.
Right.
You know, if you're writing a Wolverine book, the worst thing you can do is immediately have him fight Sabretooth.
Sure.
So, new from the beginning, let's take Sabretooth off stage. You know, eventually we're going to get there. That's going to be my end game, is right. He's going to fight Sabretooth. But to make that even matter, we have to get rid of him for a long time. Because we've seen them clash over and over again. So the question becomes, okay, who's Wolverine going to fight? And Omega Red is, you know, just standing over here being like,
yeah,
holding up a tentacle. Like, how about me? I thought he's a character that could, you know, he's worthy of exploring further. And so what I had was, you know, Beast messing him up. Beast killing him and bringing him back and making him an agent of X-Force. Or, I mean, sort of a sleeper agent of X-Force. And then he doesn't realize that he's being surveilled, you know, as he goes around and works with the vampires and everything else. So Beast is using him as a tool. And Omega Red, you know, is betrayed over and over again by everybody. So he makes with a perfect character to at first request amnesty and later to turn against the mutants entirely and try to take them all down by returning, going to Mikhail and, you know, begging for his favor.
Yeah.
I don't know that he's redeemed.
Yeah.
I mean,
but they kind of,
Omega Red has done some really gross things.
Like, yeah.
You can't redeem that guy.
But no. Yeah. Everybody just,
at least like Hannibal, you know, putting his evil to good use.
Yeah. That's a good way to look at it. Yeah, for sure. Anybody who doesn't know what we're talking about, go read the Wikipedia entry of Omega Red. He did some bad stuff, especially in the 90s. I mean, he was a character of the 90s, really, but the 90s were very edgy. Let's just say that. But I do like the way that, like, you know, he is maybe not redeemable, but people do kind of, you know, trust him, I guess, to be on the team as much as one can. Which I think is, you know, it says a lot about them as people. Like, hey, we're all kind of broken, you know, like, you're just in this and, you know,
yeah, every one of the characters is messed up.
Yeah.
There's nobody there who's just, you know, bright and cheery and ready to do good in the world. They're all,
yeah,
sort of drag assing into the office being like, oh no, not this again.
I love that you had X-Force be security at the Hellfire Gala. I think that's a really fun idea. Because that is a very important job, obviously, and, you know, one that gets blown up in the most recent one. But it's kind of below them a little bit too. They're like, you know, they don't even get to hang out at a party. They just kind of have to stand outside.
But it's a great way to, like, keep them under control, because all these people, you don't want them rubbing elbows and drinking at a party.
No.
Like, none of them are well behaved.
No.
So as long as they're, you know, guard us instead.
Yeah. How about that? You have a job to do. Well, that's, I mean, I hadn't really thought about it until just this second, but that's really what sets them apart from, like, the Hellions, who are like, not, you don't want them at the party, but they're going to show up at the party. Whereas X-Force is like, we have a job.
Yeah.
Like,
you don't want Kid Omega talking up diplomats or Omega Red sidling up beside you at the urinals.
No. He would take up all three, I think. I assume they only have three urinals in the men's room. Maybe that's a bit short-sighted. You also had it for a period of, speaking of Hellfire Galley, you also had Deadpool show up for several issues as annoyed that he wasn't asked in the first place to join, which is really funny, and then just becomes part of the team. And I think that's, was that on the table, like, from the beginning of, like, eventually I'll have Deadpool in the group, or was that sort of?
You know, it's sort of like Sabretooth.
Sure.
Fighting Wolverine, it's, you have X-Force, it's obvious to install Deadpool. And so I didn't want to do the obvious thing right away. So we kept him off stage until he sort of annoyingly earned his position on the squad. Mm-hmm. And then eventually decides he doesn't want to be part of it anyway.
Right.
You know, it's that kind of, that Groucho Marx thing. Like, you know, I can't remember the exact phrasing, but he would never want to be included in a club that would invite him.
Right. Well, and I also love that he, Sage calls him up, or maybe Domino calls him up and is like, hey, are you going to come back? We need your help. And he's like, no, I'm an Avenger now. That's a very Deadpool thing to do.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, the mutants are in ruins and they're calling him up desperately asking for help. And he's like, I can't help you. I'm busy. I'm an Avenger. But He's also saying, I'm super busy right now in the middle of a mission. And they're like, this is actually a video call.
Right.
And he's sitting there, you know, in his thong at a pool in Vegas.
I mean, that's exactly what you want from Wade. He can't be like the most upstanding, upstanding character.
It was so much fun treating him a little bit like Kid Omega for a while there, though, where he just kept trying to get on the island and get on the island.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh yeah, because that was at a period of time
he parachuted in and
yeah,
he'd be destroyed by missiles, and a rain of Deadpool parts would come down on the beach. And, you know, he'd pop up out of the sand, and Wolverine would be waiting there with his arms crossed, and hack off his head and put him in a garbage bag and take him back to the mainland.
Do you have a head canon for how many times individual characters died?
I have no idea. Countless.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, that is the beauty of the entire like ethos early on, is that because resurrection's a thing and these guys are effectively on suicide missions, they can just do it. They can just go and blow themselves up and they'll just come back.
If you're going to hand me resurrection, I'm going to take advantage of that.
Absolutely.
But you know, the thing that I love about working for Marvel is they really lean into every creator's talent and sort of aesthetic. They figure out who you are and they're like, okay, let this person do that. So Marvel's been great about being like, you know, Ben Percy's messed up. Let's give him the messed up scary stuff.
Well, yeah, you mentioned you've also concurrently been working on Wolverine, and yeah, like the first arc or the early arcs of Wolverine, I have to deal with vampires, and like he teams up with Ghost Rider, which you're also writing, and everything like that. And that book is more, it's definitely, you know, secret agent-y stuff, but it's a lot more horror-y than I was maybe expecting. But as you mentioned earlier, you're a big horror comic guy, so that makes a lot of sense.
Can't help myself.
Yeah. And look, vampires are canon in the Marvel universe. Why not use them once in a while? I think that's a genius move.
I mean, and there was a reason for using them besides the fact that I like horror. I mean, I was thinking about thematics and the fact that Wolverine is essentially eternal. You know, he's essentially an immortal. And I know that some nerds will be like, well, actually, about that as well, but he keeps coming back.
Yeah. You
know? He can't be destroyed. And whether it's, you know, a nuclear blast, or he's burned out by the sun, or whatever else, like Wolverine's still here. So I just like that idea of hit him against an enemy that's kind of a dark shadow, where the vampires have that same skill set, that same power, and yet they use it for ill. You know, whereas Wolverine, the longer he lives, it's almost like the more he, like the vampires, the longer they live, the more they view human life as irrelevant. But Wolverine, the longer he lives, the more he recognizes that human life is so vulnerable and precious.
Right.
And he needs to do the best he can to protect it. Unless you get on the wrong side of him, and then he'll...
Right, of course. Like, he's still...
Hack your limbs off.
What he does best, he still... What is it? What I do is not very nice. I forget the phrase that was used only 1 million times in the early comics.
Only 1 million. 1 million and one times. Now that we again here. What I do... I'm the best I am at what I do, but what I do, not very nice.
Yeah.
It's a mouthful.
The end of the X-Force saga, even though it was running concurrently with Fall of X and into Fall of the House of X, specifically takes place before all that. Was that something early on that you, or like when that was kind of shaking out, you're like, actually that makes more sense if this wraps up before that storyline? Or was it, when did, you know, what's the logistics, I guess, of having that happen that way?
Of having X-Force... Like, and before the rest of the stuff? Is that what you're saying? Or
yeah, I mean, because even though they were coming out kind of after Fall of the House of X had already happened, like the storyline ends before it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it just started to get logistically complicated towards the end. And it made sense for X-Force to be done as those other things were taking off. But the timing just didn't work out perfectly, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Any alignment. I mean, comic book time's always squishy. It's like,
oh,
this comes out once a month, but these five issues could take place in the course of a day.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one. I mean, like when you even think about it, like 50 issues sounds like a lot, and it is a lot, but then it's like, it's 5 real years But who knows how long that actually took in the span of, you know, the Krakoa era. Like, is there an internal and maybe I'm just missing it. Maybe it's outright said, but like, how long was Krakoa actually a nation? Or is that not something I should know?
Honestly, I don't know.
Okay. Right. Like,
I would say count the Hellfire Galas.
I think you're probably right about that. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Ben Percy. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Pleasure.
And congratulations again on X-Force. And as we are recording this, there are 3 issues left in Wolverine, I believe. Before you hit also 50 with that.
Yeah, I was doing some accounting the other day, and I realized that with X-Force, which has Logan at the helm, with Wolverine, with the events and the crossovers, and with the Long Night audio drama graphic novel adaptation, right, that it's 130 issues.
Wow.
Of Wolverine content that I've written. And then I have the 10 episode, 2 10 episode seasons of the podcast. And I'm not going to say I'm done because stay tuned. But I feel very lucky to have spent this much time as the custodian of my favorite character.
Absolutely. You join the ranks of Chris Claremont, Larry Hama, like some of these legends in the realm, who got to write for a really long time. So again, congratulations and thank you very much for joining us. It was maybe my favorite book in the run, X-Force. So thank you very much.
You sick bastard.
Do you have anything you would like to plug before we let you go?
Sure. I mean, I'm a novelist as well. Mm-hmm. And a few years ago, I decided I kind of wanted to launch my own DC or Marvel universe. And so I created this series, a novel series called The Comet Cycle. And it has an age-old sci-fi premise. A comet comes streaking through the solar system. The planet spins through the debris field. New elements are introduced to the world, and these elements shake up the laws of physics and biology and geology, and they upend the weapon sector and the geopolitical sphere, and they create a new dawn of heroes and villains to boot. It's a lot of fun to write. I hope it's a lot of fun to read. Anyways, the first novel in the series is called The Ninth Metal. But you can read the books in any order. Just kind of like that's... read comics.
Yeah. You
know, in any order. They're sort of simultaneous narratives going on across the globe. But The Ninth Metal is the first of those books, and I'll give that a plug here.
Very great. Yeah, and you can, I'm sure, get that online and everywhere you get books.
Indeed.
Swap meets.
Yeah.
Railroad sidings.
Indeed.
Where do people get books?
Moldy basements.
The moldier the better, really. Once again, thank you very much, Benjamin Percy, for joining us on Laser Focus. Thank you all for listening. Join me again next week when my guest will be a different person. Bye-bye. Laser Focus is a production of Nerdist Industries and Legendary Digital Networks. It was produced, edited, and hosted by me, Kyle Anderson. For more, visit Nerdist.com.